From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Take a big bending bundle of star power, a handsome mug, a celebrity wife, lots of money, and mix them all up in Los Angeles, and what do you get? It's called the Beckham Experiment. That story is just ahead on Only a Game. Also, the latest from the Tour de France and a report on the growing number of jobless would-be distance runners thanking their lucky stars for the lousy economy. Also ahead, the Veterans Cup draws fun-loving, soccer-playing tricentenarians all the way up to octogenarians.
It's wonderful. It's the best time. We play soccer, we meet wonderful people, visit attractions and museums, and we drink a lot of beer.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. After a three-year absence from our sports calendar, the Tour de Lance is back. Every day, more than 150 riders strap on their helmets and climb onto their saddles for what is actually called the Tour de France. And every afternoon, newspapers around the world write headlines about the results of just one man. That man, Lance Armstrong, is still in third place, just 2 seconds behind teammate Alberto Contador and 8 seconds behind Italian Rinaldo Nocentini. Bonnie D. Ford has been covering the tour for ESPN. She joins me now on the line from Colmar, France. Bonnie, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. It's great to be back.
The return of Armstrong has, of course, brought hordes of American media back to the event, which might be a bother for the folks who paid attention to the tour long before a guy named Lance came onto the scene. How are organizers, riders, fans, etc., handling the return of the circus that follows Lance Armstrong?
Bill, I'll gently correct you in just one regard, and that is there actually aren't hordes of American reporters here. Largely because, as you know, a lot of American news organizations have been hit hard by budget cuts. I will say, though, that the media frenzy here has been quite reminiscent of the old days and maybe then some. The daily scrum at Armstrong's bus is so huge that it's actually physically impossible sometimes to get up to the area where you can see and talk to him. So we've been dependent to some extent on the Astana press liaison, who stands next to him as he's doing interviews at the barricades and plays the tape back for us in the press room. So it's a bit like Charlie's Angels, in a sense.
A lot has been made of the relationship between Astana lead rider Alberto Contador and Lance Armstrong. Is this relationship really as contentious as it has been made out to be?
I think that there's been some exaggeration, just in the sense that they don't really know each other well enough to be feuding. There's also a language barrier. There's an age gap of 11 years. So they really, I don't think, know each other very well. I'm sure they've sized each other up as athletes or tried to. And they're both extremely competitive, and they both want to win. So if you could want to call that a feud, it's a feud. I call it, you know, two alpha dogs being on the same team, basically.
Meanwhile, Armstrong has lost one of his main supporters on Astana. Levi Leipheimer dropped out on Friday due to a broken wrist. Leipheimer was in the mix as a possible tour leader himself. So what does that loss mean for the team?
It's really unfortunate, I think. Levi has gained quite a following in the United States in the last few years. He's a small guy physically with a tremendous amount of stamina and power for his size. He's won the Tour of California, which is the most prestigious race we have now in the United States, 3 times in a row. In cycling parlance, I think what Levi represented was an option. He was a card to play for Astana. He's a guy that could go up in a breakaway if the team didn't want to work at the front of the peloton. He's capable of winning a stage under certain circumstances, and he certainly would have been capable of helping either Armstrong or Contador, although most of us think that his loyalties probably lay with Armstrong.
Bonnie, there are 19 other teams of 9 riders each, and we have yet to mention any of them. Maybe we should start with a guy who's actually in the lead. Rinaldo Nocentini has worn the yellow jersey for quite a number of days now, but he still doesn't seem to be much of a favorite. Why is that?
He is what I like to call the accidental yellow jersey, and there are riders who not to disrespect his talent at all, but there are riders who, for one reason or another, get into the lead and they're left there by the true contenders simply because it's convenient. He's enjoying it. He's the first Italian to wear the yellow jersey in, I think, 9 years. So the Tifosi are very happy. And he's a happy guy. When you see him in the morning, when you see him at night, he's even happy when he's rolling out of the anti-doping control pen. He's really enjoying his 15 minutes plus the same.
Who else should we be watching for this week?
You know, I think a lot of eyes are on two other guys, Andy Schleck from Saxo Bank, the young Luxembourg rider. He's a guy that I think most people think is very, very capable of landing on the podium. Cadel Evans, the Australian, who's been the runner-up at the Tour the last 2 years, often criticized for his tactics, for being too passive. He's tried to change that up a bit and hasn't gained a lot of ground here, but he's someone that certainly, if he attacks in some of the high mountain stages, he's going to be marked. And finally, the duo of Brad Wiggins, the British cyclist who won 6 Olympic medals in the last 3 Olympics, rides for Garmin Slipstream, and team leader Christian Vandeveld. They're both still in the top 10.
Bonnie, I don't want to jinx things, but so far there hasn't been a single positive doping test. Nobody's been banned for skipping out to avoid the testers, and the French police haven't even raided anybody's hotel room so far. Is it possible that this event might actually escape without a single doping scandal?
So I wrote about that today, and it feels a little weird, I have to say. We're so accustomed to sort of having these things blow up in our faces as reporters several times during the first couple weeks of the tour, and so it seems almost ominously quiet. But I guess, remember the old line from The Shining where Nicholson says, just because I'm not typing doesn't mean I'm not writing? Just because we haven't heard about a result doesn't mean that there isn't one in the pipeline. But also remember that these samples are now kept for years and years and years. They can be retested weeks down the line, months down the line, even years down the line for new substances. So we'll hope not, but the standings in this tour aren't necessarily going to stay the same down the line.
Well, now, of course, I'm curious about your best guess about the standings once this race ends. Who wins this thing? Do we see Armstrong winning an unprecedented 8th tour, or does somebody else spoil the party?
I think most people here think that it's Contador's race to lose. Being 11 years younger and being the kind of explosive climber that he is, if it comes down to a mano, Contador would have the advantage. But Armstrong's experience, his savvy, those cannot be discounted. The one attack that Contador mounted, Armstrong said he didn't respond to because of cycling etiquette, which says that when your teammate's down the road, you don't go after him.
Mm-hmm.
So at a certain point in time, we'll see if etiquette rules or if people decide to stop being polite.
Bonnie D. Ford covers cycling and other sports as well for ESPN. Bonnie, thank you very much for joining me.
Still always a pleasure.
The 2009 Major League All-Star Game featured spectacular defensive plays, timely hitting, and even a jilted knuckleballer. But it also featured revenues down from last year's mid-season celebration in New York, as well as a new, allegedly more charity-minded initiative. Adam Allington of member station KWMU in St. Louis reports on the changing business model of baseball's All-Star Game.
During last week's All-Star Game parade to Busch Stadium, Chrissy Fisher ditched work for a chance to see her favorite Cardinal, Yadier Molina, up close.
I love Yadi. I love Yadi before he got big.
As Molina's car rolled by, he tossed a T-shirt a few feet away from Fisher, and she pounced.
Yeah! From a pregnant woman!
Oh, that was quite rude.
You just took that from a pregnant lady.
I know that was rude, but I had it.
It's that kind of enthusiasm that Major League Baseball is hoping will transform the Midsummer Classic from a one-off TV event into a destination vacation, an experience that fans can buy and soak up at a variety of price points.
My name's Tommy Maine. I'm from Alabama, and this is my 18th All-Star Game. I make it as my vacation every year.
Maine says it was just a few years ago that he could still get tickets to the Home Run Derby for about $10. Now he says he's lucky to score Derby tickets for less than $300. Still, despite the inflation, he says the experience is worth it.
Old as I am, I made a vow I'm going to do it till I die. So this is number 18. If the good Lord is willing, it'll be 19 in California next year.
Major League Baseball says the 2008 All-Star Game generated about $150 million for New York City. Early numbers for St. Louis project a boost of around $60 million. The Yankees were ripped by the press for charging thousands of dollars for tickets, resulting in no shortage of empty seats. Seat prices were cut in half for St. Louis, with an average ticket costing about $600. But whether you're talking about 6,000 or 600, most average fans won't be going to the game. 8-year-old Evarista Huelskamp and her mother paid $30 for tickets to the so-called Fan Fest in St. Louis. Evarista met her favorite Cardinal, Albert Pujols. She said she had no idea he was so
big, huge, tall.
Evarista's mother, Sue Huelskamp, says the cheaper alternatives like FanFest are a good way to give her kids some All-Star memories without spending a mint.
We're going to go to that home run derby, but for standing room was $180 on the internet. So we decided we couldn't afford that because we're a family of five, and it would just be too expensive. So that's why we decided to go to this other festival that they're going to have.
So should fans brace themselves for another price gouge next year when the game heads to a big money town like L.A.?
I don't think because of the perception that we're in a big market is going to drive up the ticket price.
Tim Mead is the vice president of communications for the Los Angeles Angels.
Baseball is very cognizant of the economy and the situation, and I don't anticipate too much differential than what we saw in St. Louis this year.
Maury Brown is a writer for the Business of Sports Network. He says even in a down economy, sports fans will scrimp and save to attend their favorite events.
People have a tendency to spend more. They will forego other things, maybe a vacation, or maybe make the All-Star Game their vacation destination. So it is one of those things to where I think that the prize points are probably reasonable, not for everyone, but probably, you know, well within reasonable limits.
As for whether cities can afford events like the All-Star Game, skeptics claim that by the time costs for police overtime and sprucing up downtowns are factored in, any gain for the regional economy is usually a wash. Detroit hosted the All-Star Game in 2005. Bob Rosbach is with the Detroit Economic Growth Corporation. He says hosting events like the All-Star Game is as much about selling your city as it is about cashing in on a short-term tourism bump.
Successfully managing a giant event like this demonstrates your capability as a city to manage the big stuff. So you're getting free advertising, if nothing else, even if it's a wash on the dollars cost versus the dollars raised from tourists and companies that come in for events.
Next week, the Walt Disney Company, which owns the Los Angeles Angels, will unveil their logo for the 2010 All-Star Game. Mickey Mouse signature gloves, anyone? For Only a Game, I'm Adam Allington in St. Louis.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. It has been a real logistical nightmare, but we've cracked it, said John Thompson, the drummer for the band Cold Feet. Said logistical nightmare involved the convening of 580 drummers and their drum kits to break the world record for number of drummers keeping the same beat simultaneously, which the drummers did Monday at the National Indoor Arena in Birmingham, England. It sounded like this. When silence finally descended over the arena, the drummers had raised over $50,000 for charity. Said one of the organizers, it isn't difficult getting everyone playing at the same speed, it's getting them to stop that's the problem. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the David Beckham experiment, boom, bust, or both. But first, during this economic slump, a lot of things have slowed down, like manufacturing, trade, and hiring. But while the economy has been plodding along, marathoners and other runners have been speeding past it. The Wall Street Journal's Reed Albergati looked at that phenomenon in his article, Fast Times for Jobless Runners, and he joins me now. Reed, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks a lot. Good to be here.
The fields in many marathons and triathlons, even those with fairly steep entry fees, are filling up faster than they have in recent years when the economy was better. How significant is the increase in participation?
It's pretty significant, especially considering, you know, the economy is down. People have less money to spend on these extraneous things. But in some cases, you know, they're filling up in minutes as opposed to hours or days, which is pretty amazing. I mean, it's like getting concert tickets trying to get into the New York City Triathlon. It's amazing.
Normally, more entrants means more first-time or inexperienced runners in the field, and that usually results in slower average times. But what's been happening so far this year?
Yeah, you would think that that'd be the case. And as marathons have become really popular, times have been getting slower. But we looked with the help of athlinks.com, which is a website that compiles data on all these race results. We looked at Boston Marathon qualifying times for 2010, and we found that this year, based on that benchmark, the times have actually been getting faster. You know, people are getting laid off or actually training more and getting faster. Maybe not racing in Boston, but at least running the times that would theoretically get them into Boston.
You mentioned the website athlinks.com, and they turned up the information that average times got worse in 2007 and 2008. Tell us a little bit about the theories that explain why times are getting better now.
Well, I mean, it's really a pretty simple theory. It's basically people, you know, get laid off, or, you know, maybe they switch careers and they're doing something that's less demanding, and they end up spending more time running and also more time recovering. I mean, a lot of people I talked to for this story said that it's tough to really recover and rest, and just the mental strain of the workday actually slows you down a lot. You know, one person I talked to was working a full-time job, got laid off, spent a month unemployed, and ran this amazing marathon time, and then got a new job and said, man, I mean, maybe I should be training for the Olympics instead of working. Now she's thinking of going back to a part-time job because of her, you know, this great marathon time. It just never would have occurred to me that something like that would happen.
So that pesky 9-to-5 job can really get in the way of your sleeping late enough to recover for your 10-mile run a little later in the day.
Yeah, you know, I think if you talk to professional athletes, it makes sense, too, because I think they spend a lot, especially endurance athletes who do it full-time, they spend a lot of time just sitting around recovering. You know, I think that's one of the big differences between, you know, somebody who does this seriously but on a very amateur level while working a full-time job and someone who does it as a professional.
Well, what about the professionals and the elite athletes? As the economy has slowed down, what's happened with their times?
Well, yeah, you know, at the Oregon Track Club, where, you know, they recruit elite runners out of college to, you know, ultimately, hopefully, go to the Olympics, they say that they've got to turn people away who last year, in years past, would have made the team no problem. Hmm. I mean, this is another surprise for me in reporting this story. I would have thought that if anybody thought they had a chance to one day go to the Olympics, that you'd postpone any kind of business career. But actually, that's not the case. I mean, being an Olympic athlete is pretty tough, and usually you live sort of like this austere lifestyle. And people actually gave up their Olympic dreams for careers. Now, the job market is so bad that they're saying, well, you know, it's a no-brainer. You know, go for the Olympics and go for gold.
What the heck? I can't make $1 million in the next 3 weeks anyway. I might as well train.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there's not as much promise of the big paycheck right out of college.
During the various ups and downs of the U.S. economy throughout history, certain businesses, such as movies and to some extent the theater, have been essentially recession-proof. People always need the escape. You know, they need the fantasy. I wonder if marathons and triathlons qualify for the same distinction these days.
Oh, yeah. I mean, one person I talked to for the story actually used the term recession-proof. She actually left her job as a school teacher to go and start a triathlon promotion business, And she said, you know, it's a little scary actually leaving your steady paycheck job to start a new business in this economy. But she really said it's recession-proof. I mean, it's one area people just not only are they not willing to give it up, but they want to do it more.
Reed, I'm feeling very encouraged by this conversation because it seems to me when somebody loses his or her job, there are two possibilities. One, you go home and eat a lot of Doritos and drink a lot of beer and watch a lot of TV. And the other is you go out and run and get yourself in shape. And it sounds like the latter is what a lot of people are doing.
And you know what? If you do the latter, you can probably do the former and not gain too much weight. So.
Reed, we're only into July, so this year's improved times are part of a fairly short trend. Should course record holders all over the country be rooting for the economic stimulus package to finally kick in so that these runners can go back to work and stop threatening their record times?
That is a really good point, and I would say especially masters athletes, if you hold the 40 and over 100-meter dash record or something like that, you might want to worry.
Reed Albergati is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and he wrote the article Fast Times for Jobless Runners. Reed, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Members of the Los Angeles Galaxy no doubt considered Thursday night's game in New York a success. Not only did the Galaxy win 3-1, but Landon Donovan and David Beckham did not publicly engage in fisticuffs. Beckham is the subject of The Beckham Experiment, a new book by Sports Illustrated senior writer Grant Wall. Donovan was one of Wall's most candid informants, maintaining that David Beckham was a lazy captain, an irresponsible teammate, and a tightwad as well. Grant Wall joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Grant, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Your book has been receiving a great deal of attention, in part at least because of Landon Donovan's explicit criticism of David Beckham. One charge that I found surprising was that even when he was in L.A., Beckham had shortchanged his teammates in terms of commitment to the Galaxy. Beckham has fired back that he's always been a responsible professional. Was Donovan's contention to the contrary fair?
I think actually that it was, and that's surprising for a lot of people who followed David Beckham's European career. It was very surprising for me. I've interviewed a lot of Beckham's teammates and coaches in Europe over the years, and one thing they have always said is that Beckham is 100% committed with full effort every day in practice and in games. And in the second half of the 2008 MLS season, as the Galaxy went 3 months without a victory and fell to the bottom of the MLS standings, it was clear to anyone who watched every game of miserable soccer that Beckham was not giving 100%. I saw every one of those games. And then Donovan and a couple other players also said that in the second half of 2008, Beckham was not giving full effort in practice. He could have been doing more during this team's slide. And that was surprising to me as well. You know, I think Donovan wanted this to be public, wanted to provide Beckham some accountability and hold him accountable and see how he'd respond to that.
Well, you point out in the book that shortly after Beckham's arrival in Los Angeles, his people began calling the shots regarding personnel decisions, not just the captaincy, but the scheduling of exhibition games, eventually the coach as well. To what extent did the Galaxy front office know what acquiring David Beckham would entail?
I think that they knew he would provide a jolt to the team in a very positive way in some ways, as far as ticket sales skyrocketed, sponsorships skyrocketed. Beckham and the Galaxy have made millions of dollars off his arrival in America. But at the same time, the Galaxy gave a lot of control to Beckham's people. Beckham's best friend and personal manager actually approached the Galaxy months before Beckham's arrival in 2007 and asked them, "What are you doing about the captaincy?" Now, the captaincy is a very important thing in soccer. There's a lot of ego attached to it, a lot of pride. And Donovan had been the captain, and suddenly he has people from the Galaxy approaching him, telling him that they think Beckham should be the captain immediately upon arrival instead of earning it over a matter of time within the team. And Terry Byrne, this guy, actually conducted the coaching search for Ruud Gullit, the former Dutch World Player of the Year who was hired toward the end of 2007. Ruud Gullit was a complete disaster, only lasted 19 games on the job before he was pushed out. It was a complete napalming of the management structure by a guy named Tim Leiwicki, who is the CEO of the Galaxy's ownership group, and had actually signed Beckham back in 2007. What Leiwicki then did was to hire Bruce Arena, probably the most famous coach in the history of American soccer, to coach the Galaxy, and made a point at the time of saying that David Beckham and his management had no role whatsoever in the hiring of Bruce Arena, and that they were probably actually not entirely happy with Leiwicki because of that.
As far as soccer is concerned, the Beckham experiment has been a failure. The Galaxy is at a better record when David Beckham hasn't played, which is remarkable, and the team failed to make the playoffs in 2007 and 2008. Is there any reason to think that this will change through the rest of the 2009 season?
Well, it will be fascinating to watch for me and I think a lot of other sports fans here in America. How does Beckham reintegrate into the team now that he has come in during midseason? The Galaxy have now won four games in a row, including Beckham's first game back on Thursday night. But if we learned a couple of things, it was that this is Donovan's team. On the field, where he had a goal and an assist and continued a really good run of form that he's been showing for a couple of months now. And also Donovan's team inside the locker room. People I've talked to say that that is Donovan's locker room now. He is the captain once again. Beckham is not. And now the challenge is to, for the Galaxy at least, to move past this controversy and try and get Beckham and Donovan on the same page together, at least publicly, even if they don't like each other privately.
David Beckham told the world from Milan in 2008 that he was, quote, committed to the Galaxy and his teammates in Los Angeles. You called that announcement, and I'm quoting again, self-serving doublespeak. Beckham has recently said that he plans to finish his career with the Galaxy in Los Angeles. More doublespeak?
I get the sense, hearing him say over and over again how committed he is to this project, that his definition of the word commitment must be different from the rest of us, because he's a part-time player this year. He wants to be a part-time player with the Galaxy next season. And if that's the case, he will have spent four seasons, technically, of his contract with the Galaxy, and only one of them will have been an entire season. So he's sort of insulting our intelligence and the language itself by saying he's fully committed to a team that he only spends half the time with.
How much is it likely to help Major League Soccer if the Galaxy not only makes the playoffs this season but goes on and wins the championship, with David Beckham being one of the fellows who hoists the cup over his head?
Well, it would be a great story, and Beckham is famous for these remarkable comebacks in his career after getting a red card in the 98 World Cup and becoming really the most hated man in England because of it. He came back a year later and recaptured the fans by being part of Manchester United's historic run to three championships in 99. He made a similar comeback at Real Madrid after he signed with the Galaxy in 2007. Came back, rejoined the team, and led it to a championship in Spain, rejoined the England national team. He's capable of these types of comebacks, and if he could be part of a resurgence with the Galaxy and help lead them to a championship in MLS, I think that would be a real achievement.
I'm speaking with Grant Wall, the author of The Beckham Experiment. You're listening to Only a Game. Grant, I want to return to this Landon Donovan-David Beckham relationship, or lack of same, because that's going to draw a certain number of people who don't follow soccer into this thing, the soap opera aspect of it. To what extent do you think they really have patched things up? And were you surprised that Donovan was as candid as he was when you spoke with him?
I don't think, despite their public statements to the contrary, that they really have patched things up personally. They're human. I don't see how that would be possible based on the criticisms that Donovan issued and then Beckham's sharp response that Donovan had been unprofessional. But they do need, at least publicly, to be seem to be getting along. Otherwise, this team would be completely dysfunctional on the field. We'll have to wait and see. I mean, Donovan, I think, has always been a very honest interview. He's one of the reasons I wanted to do this book, because I knew that he would tell me what he thought and would continue speaking to me no matter how things went on the field, whether they were going well or whether things were going south, as they eventually did.
All right, Grant, I'm going to try and put you on the spot. You've been saying we'll have to wait and see, but you've probably seen more of the Los Angeles Galaxy over the last couple of years than anybody who isn't employed by the team. How are they going to do for the rest of this season?
Well, they've had one game together with Beckham back, and Beckham didn't really stand out. He hadn't played a competitive game in 5 weeks, so he's still regaining fitness and getting used to a lot of new teammates. But Donovan is playing at such a high level right now, which has continued since the Confederations Cup, when he scored a wonderful goal against Brazil in that game on the counterattack. Donovan has gotten to a point where right now he is playing the best soccer of his career, and he's doing it consistently. It seems like just about every game. He doesn't hide sometimes like he used to do in the past. So I think it's possible for this team to rally, and it's a huge challenge for the coach, Bruce Arena, to get Donovan and Beckham on the same page and playing well together, because they're two very good players, and ideally, they would work well together on the field, and that would lead to Galaxy victories. It's still possible.
Grant Wall is the author of The Beckham Experiment, How the World's Most Famous Athlete Tried to Conquer America. The book is published by Crown, and the author joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Grant, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Glory, glory, Man United. Glory, glory, Man United. Glory, glory, Man United. And the Reds go marching on.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at AVFX.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Guinness World Record for number of people simultaneously skinny dipping fell this week, taking advantage of an apparent loophole in the rules for setting this particular record. Although the skinny dippers all dipped at the same time, they were not all in the same place. 317 of them were in the community pool at the Whitetail Nudist Resort in Virginia. Wow. Whoever named that place certainly had a sense of who belonged in the pool and who didn't. Anyway, 134 of the record setters were immersed in the pool at Sky Farm in Basking Ridge, New Jersey. So many others elsewhere in the U.S. and in Canada were also skinny dipping that the official count is still in progress. Caroline Hawkins, a spokesperson for the American Association of Nude Recreation, said, "Whatever the record is, we can't wait to break it next year." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a soccer tournament in which age is a requirement rather than a disadvantage. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
For only the second time in his pro career, Tiger Woods missed the cut in a major. His 4-over 74 put him one stroke away from weekend play at the British Open. Meanwhile, after two rounds, the lead was shared by good old Tom Watson, who's 59, and an American named Steve Marino, who was an alternate and had never played a true links course before. And they say golf is a difficult game.
Not for this guy. It's a screwy tournament so far, of course. You had the Tom Watson revival, and then you had this guy. And part of the reason, of course, is the weather keeps going back and forth. They had a beautiful day for the first round and a really terrible one for the second one.
A report in the New York Times this week revealed the extent to which sponsors choose their athletes' outfits for the major golf tournaments. Apparently, the marketing folks decided months ago that today at Turnberry, Sergio Garcia will wear a blue shirt with white piping. And if he had been playing, Tiger would have looked just dandy in white with a stripe. Now, he's missed the cut, so maybe Tiger gets to pick his own clothes.
Well, more to the point, who's sponsoring John Daly? I mean, is Peter Mac sponsoring him? The guy's walking around like a Yes album cover.
Albert Pujols made a couple of excellent plays in the field at the All-Star game on Tuesday evening. Before the game, he made an interesting play as well. He said that if he ever tested positive for performance-enhancing drugs, he would give back all the money the St. Louis Cardinals have ever paid him. This sounds like a guy who perhaps is trying to make a point.
I think he's trying to make a point, and I hope he's honest, because if he ever gets caught, he's going to be the most hilarious victim of this entire thing. You know, this may be right up there with the basketball player who was going to give back her scholarship money if they didn't win the Final Four.
Pedro Martinez returned to the major leagues on Wednesday. He's a Philly, as you and I anticipated that he might be. And Phil's manager, Charlie Manuel, said, quote, Martinez is throwing much better than last year, and he is in tremendous shape. And so they immediately put him on the disabled list. Do you think Mr. Manuel has a different definition for tremendous shape than you or I might have?
He's in tremendous shape for a guy on the disabled list.
He looks great sitting there.
He does. He looks very nice on the disabled list.
A score of current and former National Football League players were on Capitol Hill on Wednesday, Charlie. They apparently walked the halls of Congress and encouraged lawmakers to, quote, ask tough questions if an owner lockout looks imminent in 2011. You think Congress took notice of that?
I think they took notice of it, and I think they will take notice of it right up until the time the lockout happens, and then they'll ignore the whole thing, because the power is with management in this particular episode.
The National Basketball Association players' contract is also set to expire in less than 2 years, so I suppose it's just a coincidence that Commissioner David Stern announced this week that fewer than half of the NBA teams made a profit last season.
Well, once again, I'm going to apply my usual standard, and when David Stern sells me an apple from a steam grate on Fifth Avenue in New York, then I'll worry about his league being in trouble.
Don't hold your breath on that one.
Okay.
Right? My favorite headline of the week reads, Best Buy is hoping its partnership with Magic Johnson will show just how urban it is. So that ought to do it, right?
Well, this is Magic Johnson, you know, the entrepreneur striking again. He has movie theaters, and now he has Best Buy, you know, moving into the urban market. Maybe it'll work and maybe it doesn't. I did discover this weekend, because I was on a plane with them, that Best Buy is the sponsor of the Chicago Fire soccer team.
Excellent.
Because they were all wearing their gear, and it all said Best Buy on it. And I knew they weren't referring to professional soccer, so I figured it was the chain of stores.
Yao Ming will buy his former team.
Of bad business.
Yes, he's going to buy his former team, the Shanghai Sharks. Since Yao left for Houston, the Sharks tied for the worst deficit in the 14-year history of the league, and the team was in danger of not even playing next season. And no money. I wonder if having a very tall owner will turn things around for the Sharks.
Well, I mean, he's certainly got enough to invest in it right now, and he's obviously looking for a career after basketball, since it looks like his career in basketball may come to a premature end. I wish him luck. I didn't realize that they kept statistics on this sort of thing in the Chinese Basketball League.
NASCAR driver Jeremy Mayfield has tested positive for methamphetamines again. The list of people allegedly plotting against him, at least according to Mayfield, now includes his stepmother. Is it fair to say his return to racing would seem to be, unlikely at this point?
Boy, William Faulkner died too soon for this clan, didn't he? you know, the NASCAR is not taking any guff from people. They're not really fond of having guys who are accused of using methamphetamine driving machines at 200 miles an hour. But the new twist of selling out the stepmom and calling her nasty names, even though none of them have anything to do with her eyesight, and she claims to have seen, you know, on 30 occasions this taking place, this gets better and better.
Richard Gasquet had been banned from tournaments by the International Tennis Federation, but, oops, not so fast, he told the ITF that his positive test came as a result of kissing a woman in a nightclub, and the ITF believed him. Do you think it was the romantic nature of Gasquet's excuse that swayed the panel's vote on that one?
I'd like to know exactly how many of the members of the panel actually own the Brooklyn Bridge.
And how many are still looking
because
to buy it?
These people sound like you could hold them up by FedEx.
And finally, Charlie, I give you the story of 6-year-old Braden Furlow, who shot a hole-in-one. And I would say that this 6-year-old is a natural for the PGA Tour in, say, 8 or 10 years, except that I'm not sure the ball that he used would be allowed on said tour.
Well, yes, because he used a SpongeBob SquarePants ball. Now, the question becomes, is if he maintains his relationship with SpongeBob Enterprises, Inc., LLP, will it be the SpongeBob people who tell him how to dress once he gets on the tour?
And boy, would he be a great-looking golfer out there.
He still looks better than John Daly looked, I might add.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. His most recent book is Idiot America, and he joins me on this program each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Ready, SpongeBob SquarePants, SpongeBob SquarePants, SpongeBob SquarePants, SpongeBob SquarePants!
Under a shelter that will soon be jammed with soccer players waiting for the lightning to subside, Christine Wollaston-Jury, who plays for a Massachusetts team of over 60 women, explains some of the attractions of the annual Veterans Cup tournament.
It's wonderful. It's the best time. We play soccer, we meet wonderful people, we go and see interesting places, and we visit attractions and museums, and we drink a lot of beer.
No wonder this annual tournament, which began 11 years ago, has grown to a field of over 70 teams. The 2009 edition of the Veterans Cup transpired last week in Lancaster, Massachusetts. There were teams from New England, of course, but there were also teams from Florida, from Arizona, from Hawaii, from Costa Rica. And one intrepid team of over 60 gentlemen said to have arrived on a corporate jet from Japan. They called themselves Men from the 40s, though according to the only member of the team who spoke English, the oldest of them was born in 1924.
32 is 85.
Number 32 is
today
85.
The birthday. Quite famous. His name is Yamaguchi in this competition. Everybody knows him.
Mr. Yamaguchi was easily recognizable. While his teammates all wore red uniform T-shirts and red soccer shorts, he wore gold pants. A distinction earned because, at 85, he is the player closest to 100. Unhappily for Mr. Yamaguchi and the rest of the men of the 40s, the Japanese team was outplayed by the over-60 Massachusetts Blues in that game. But Magid Mazin, a transplanted New Englander who was born in Egypt, was thoroughly impressed by the efforts of his octogenarian counterpart.
I saw him 2 years ago in North Carolina. He was 82. Fantastic. He's a role model. He is an inspiration to me.
At last week's tournament, there was inspiration everywhere. One over 60 woman with whom I spoke had come back from a torn Achilles tendon. Scores of the players had endured multiple knee surgeries. One of the referees had recovered from cancer and a heart attack. She was also wearing a knee brace. And then there were all those players who simply refused to acknowledge that soccer is a young person's sport, some of whom had played at a very high level when they were themselves young persons. I spoke to one of them in my car while we waited for the early afternoon thunder showers to pass.
Well, I was fortunate to be drafted by the Cosmos in the first years of the NASL when they had to have two token Americans on the roster.
Stanley Startzel is currently a member of one of the stronger 55 and over teams at the Veterans Cup tournament. He made that age limit with several years to spare. But back in 72, he was a North American Soccer League rookie in New York on the league's wealthiest team.
But then I asked to be traded because I heard Pelé was coming and they had to make room for his salary on the roster. So I offered to go to Philadelphia, and the rest is history. The idea would be making room for his salary, but everybody else would get $1.82. Well, yeah, we should have been on food stamps in those days.
Stanley Startzel runs a youth soccer program in Massachusetts, but during the Veterans Cup tournament, he was a player again with all the benefits and the challenges.
Things you look forward to is the massage. You get your legs massaged 15 minutes before the match and 15 minutes after. The massage tent, there's a line that starts forming, so you got to get there pretty early. So the older the divisions, the larger your bag gets, you know, in terms of medicines and liquids and things to help you recover for these games.
Once play had recommenced after the storm, players did indeed begin making their way to the massage tent. One of them was a man in his late 60s named Pepe, who was groaning softly as a masseuse named Jennifer worked on his legs.
How's this going? Is this going okay? Is he going to be able to play?
Going well. He actually already played today.
Well, you say we'll find out tomorrow?
Because I scored 3 goals today. Let's see what happens tomorrow if she helps me.
I'm going to make it up to 5 tomorrow.
I could have had 5 today.
up the hill from the massage tent on one of the several artificial turf fields in the Lancaster complex, another older player was less concerned about how well his legs would hold up than he was about what the fans he anticipated might make of his performance on the field. Anson Dorrance, who has coached the University of North Carolina women's team and the U.S. national women's team to numerous championships, was playing for a team called North Carolina United, which featured in goal current Boston Breakers and former national team coach Tony DiCicco. As game time approached, Dorrance fretted that some of his former players might soon start showing up.
I'm sure that what they're going to try to remember are the things I used to yell at them from the sidelines. So I know what I'm going to hear are all the cliches of, you know, whatever things used to drive them nuts when they were playing. And I know I'm going to hear all of that. But you know what? It's all good-natured fun. And I know they're going to have a good time teasing me and teasing Tony. And I look forward to seeing them, honestly.
If there was teasing, it apparently didn't distract Dorrance or DiCicco. North Carolina United swept through the first four games of the Veterans Cup, scoring 15 goals and allowing only four, though they did fall to the Texas Wanderers in the final, 3-2. Not so fortunate were the Arizona Antiques, an over-60 women's team from Phoenix that failed to score at all over the course of 3 days, which must have come as a disappointment, given what one of their players said before game one.
We do want to win and score a lot of goals. Hopefully we can score a lot of goals.
That's Dorothy Tejada, a 68-year-old great-grandmother of five. I was surprised to learn from Dorothy that her role on the team is to score because she did not seem a likely candidate to win many balls in the air. How tall are you, I asked.
How tall am I? About five, a little over five.
A little over five when you jump.
When I jump. I used to be taller. I used to be an inch taller.
Lots of the players in this tournament used to be taller, and all of them used to be faster, and some of them from Costa Rica and Florida used to represent their countries in the World Cup or play for professional teams, and at least one of them from Japan seems destined to play forever, which might seem like a crazy notion until you attend an event like the Veterans Cup tournament. Forty years ago, 600 Winnebagos pulled into the small town of Forest City, Iowa, home to the company that makes the iconic recreational vehicles, for the first Winnebago Grand National Rally. The RV owners toured the factory, swapped traveling tips, and generally had so much fun that they've been coming back ever since. Joining me now on the line is Doug Formanek, the Winnebago Itasca Travelers Club General Manager. Doug, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much.
This year's Grand National Rally starts tomorrow. How many visitors are you expecting?
Well, motorhome-wise, about 1,230, maybe 1,250 units, and probably 2,500 people. And these people have been coming in since the last week of June.
But they're among friends when they come.
Oh, yeah. It's all friends. You know, like someone said, this is the mother ship. We're all coming home to mom.
You offer events ranging from crafts classes to a clinic on performing CPR, but since we're a sports show, I want to focus on the driving challenges. Is it true that your drivers will race Winnebagos around an obstacle course in reverse while blindfolded?
You got that right. We do blindfold the driver, and the passenger is on the outside with a walkie-talkie telling them where to go. And it's all done under time, so it's a lot of fun. The guys and gals, they just really enjoy it. So.
Well, maybe it's just me, but racing Winnebagos backwards while blindfolded just sounds like a bad idea. Are there a lot of crashes?
No, we've never had any. You know, all the obstacles are rubber. So If they hit an obstacle, we would just deduct some points. But it isn't like we're going to go 30 miles an hour backwards.
I can't help but have noticed that Winnebago will be providing the vehicles for this backwards race. Is that so the owners don't try to soup up their RVs to get a mechanical edge?
No, not at all. We just like to keep it as fair as possible, and they do donate the motorhomes, and they're all of the same length.
I'm wondering, as these people all gather from all over the country with their Winnebagos, is there a lot of sort of raising of eyebrows and sort of saying, oh, yeah, well, I got this and you don't?
Oh, I'm sure there's some bragging rights here or there about what I have and you don't. My favorite option on the vehicle is the outside television.
And, of course, that's something that you do while the vehicle is stationary.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. No, this isn't part of the rodeo.
Doug Formanek is the general manager of the Winnebago Itasca Travelers Club. Doug, thank you very much for joining me.
Well, thank you.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Josh Levenshurs. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view my Veterans Cup photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Linda Denny of the Arizona Antiques, and she really understands what makes a radio story work.
We also have a woman from Denmark. Come bring your accent here for him.
I chatted with that player from Denmark and with her accent as well, and they were equally delightful. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.